You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
Over 7 million different animals inhabit our planet.
If you've never seen this animal, you don't know what you're missing. This thing, I called it the Arnold Schwarzenegger of buffalo, bison, cattle. And
yes!
What can they teach us?
All the muscle that's laid down around the spinous process to attach to the scapula and the cervical vertebra and then the rib cage. I mean, they needed to be strong, right? That's a given.
Many species are in crisis and need your help. Join the movement at allcreaturespod.com.
Welcome to the All Creatures Podcast. This is Chris.
And I'm Angie.
And welcome back, friend. It's been a while.
I know. Too long. No see. We always talk all the time, but we don't usually get to see each other over video chat like we do when we record. So yes, we're coming back strong with an amazing species, the gaur, which is just, I have like 50 slides. We won't get to them all, I promise. So don't turn the podcast off right now. It's just fun. It's a bovid species, which is right up Chris and I's alley. And truth be told, Chris, I can't believe the gaur has escaped me this long.
Yeah, especially you with your hooves and horns.
Hooves and horns, baby. And I've neglected the gaur has not been in my life until recently. And for those of you, to help give you a picture briefly of what we're talking about here in the intro, the gaur is also called the Indian bison. So this is a bison-like bovine cattle species, the biggest in the whole family, bigger than the water buffalo, than our American bison. I mean, and their horns, you know, I love my horns. I just recently learned about this species and I cannot believe that it's been missing in my life. So because of that, I spent a lot of time and I really did my research because I fell in love with them and I read paper after paper after paper. And I actually have some more. I think I sent you the one about bovine species and placentation and how placentas and hooves and horns matter. So we won't talk about that one. Email me if you're a real big nerd. This is just a really cool species and they have an incredible conservation story, not unlike our American bison or American buffalo. So they're still considered vulnerable by the IUCN and anywhere from 20 to 35,000 living all over Southwest Asia. So please stick around. If you're not familiar with the gaur, or even if you are, we're going to make you fall in love today because this is a handsome, handsome bovine species as well.
When you say bison, if you've never seen this animal, you don't know what you're missing. This thing, I called it the Arnold Schwarzenegger of buffalo, bison, cattle. And
yes. Well, it's a real, I mean, the females are gorgeous too, but the males are, they're both just stunning, stunning specimens and they're super muscular. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, if you like looking at muscles, which really who doesn't, I mean, this is the species for you. They are ripped. Yeah. And what I learned too, Chris, is Red Bull, the energy drink sold here in North America, the two bulls that had their horns kind of going at each other was actually created with the gaur in mind.
Yeah, no, they're massive. I mean, they are big, big boys and girls, and we're going to talk about that.
The biggest.
Yeah, yeah, and their conservation too, because they are vulnerable to extinction, and we'll talk about some of the great things India is doing with conservation. You know, and Angie's got an amazing
interview coming up. Thailand, and yeah, a lot of the countries.
Yeah, yeah, so they're doing some great work down there. Just real quick, just want to give a shout out to Amber, you know, who we had a wonderful call yesterday with.
Who's going Hi, to be Amber. Helping us. Thank yes. you. Yes.
She's going to be helping us on the podcast. Alexander, thank you for the kind words about my father's. And then a shout out to Adam, who reached out to us and is doing some great conservation work in the U.S.
And I just want to give a big high five to JRS4800, who left us an amazing review on iTunes, saying that they love our podcast. And it's always nice when fans subscribe, rate, and review on iTunes, because it helps get our numbers up and, of course, get this podcast out to more people, as it helps increase the circulation of our podcast.
Yeah, no, for sure, for sure. And I'm, you know, in last week, the new podcast I started, Mad About Horses, I have it with your blessing, and it's not going to disrupt All Creatures again. So if you're into horses and bovids and any species, check that one out. Mad About Horses, please subscribe and give me some feedback on that. Because I've been doing a horse podcast, coming into a bovid podcast, there's just so many things are kind of overlapping. So it was so much fun to do the research on this Gower, Angie. Starting off with the description, I was sitting there like, how are you going to describe that muscle? Because the muscling, it isn't like, I mean, it literally, you know, you look at some of the pictures, that hump,
it looks
like
fake.
A bicep. It does look fake.
It looks fake. That's the only way I can describe it. And so when you picture a bison, let's just say, they have that hump, and I have a whole slide or two, maybe three, about the hump physiology. Mm-hmm. So stick with me if you love humps and horns. I have a couple slides just about their horns, but just generically, that's very massive around their neck, and withers is what we call it in the horse, but where their thoracic vertebra is very, they're built up. But around it, which I guess with American bison, they're so hairy, especially in the winter months, you can't see it, but the muscling on the Indian bison or the Gower is incredible. And it's the trapezius and the latissimus dorsi, and it is ripped, like ripped. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I mean, please go to our show notes or Google a photo of these beautiful beasts, but yes, they have this shoulder hump and just massive, massive muscles. And like I said, because it's such a distinguishing feature, we're going to talk more about that when we get to fun physiology facts. But in general, the color of the Indian bison is going to be a dark reddish brown to blackish brown color with white stockings. So all my horse lovers out there, we always love when we see that in horses, right? Like when they have a solid color and then the white stockings, we call them. So it was really cool to see this on a bovid species. And their horns are stunning as well. Very, very massive. And remember, this is a wild bovine. So they all have, males and females have these horns, and they're large and they're long and they curve inwards towards each other. And on the middle of the head is this convex bump in between the two horns, which also makes their head, when they're looking at you, very, very prominent. And just to put a little more visual on the horns, the male Indian bison, each horn will be about 61 to 96 centimeters. Mm-hmm. And the spread from tip to tip will be anywhere from 89 to 134 centimeters. So pretty substantial. I don't think as big as like a water buffalo in Africa. Because I also read too that they can weigh anywhere from like 20 to 30 pounds. I think that's really massive. I think they're maybe more on the 20 pound side. It was hard for me to find a lot of details on that. Where I know from water buffaloes, because I used to have a educational horn that I would use when I'd get tours back in the day as a zookeeper. That one was about 26 pounds, just one of them.
They're heavy.
So, but in general, you think about why they have to have such strong neck muscles is if you have, even if you just have 40 pounds of horn on your head.
Yeah.
I mean, that is, let alone a big, a big head too, as far as the weight of the skull and all in the brain, you know, all the things in there. I mean, that's a lot to lift up.
Yeah.
And down, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's that's why they're so big. I mean, they are the biggest bovine in the world, and the length of just the body is anywhere from 8 to 12 feet. So that's over 3.5 meters just in the length. So that's the size of a car, right? Weight up to the males, you know, obviously bigger than the females, up to 3,300 pounds. So that's a ton and a half, or 1,500 kilograms. And so they are the size of a car, basically, you know.
Yeah. Females can get pretty big too. I mean, they're usually about 25% smaller.
Yeah.
Or I should say way less than the males, but still some big, beautiful girls.
Yeah. I mean, they can weigh up to a ton, 2,200 pounds mm-hmm. up to. Height at the withers, you were talking about that big muscle, almost 7 feet or 2.2 meters. So taller than me. I couldn't see over them. I have yet to find a cow that I've worked with that I couldn't see over their withers or the back.
Wow, that's a really good visual, Chris. Yeah. Wow. Yeah, that's really impactful to me.
It's a big animal. Mm-hmm. Very big animal.
And then, of course, we would be amiss to not mention the tail. So the tail of the Indian bison can range anywhere from 0.7 to 1 meter. So yeah,
3 feet. That's a big tail. Mm-hmm. It's a big kid. It's a big bovid. I can't call it. It's not a cow. It's bison. It's a bovid. It's huge. Looking at where they live. Now, we've already said some of this in India, Thailand, historical range, South and Southeast Asia. They were everywhere, but because of human population explosion and everything, they're really getting squeezed out, where 85% of the population now is in India. Mm-hmm. There is some rewilding. I'm going to get to that. Now, they usually like these evergreen forests, semi-evergreen deciduous trees. But, you know, this habitat, these forests that they live in, but altitude's up to almost 6,000 feet or 1,800 meters.
Yeah, I was really impressed by that. I mean, it makes sense in the different areas where they live, but... Yeah. And of course, with human urbanization and farming and agriculture, they have been seen now encroaching more into like farm grasslands.
Yeah. 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 Well, and whenever we talk about this region of the world, I just always go back to Asian elephants. And, you know, it's like their habitats are just shrinking and shrinking and shrinking. But India is doing some good work. So if you're going to look for them today, I mean, obviously you'd go to India because there is some ecotourism with them. That is a benefit. Nepal, Myanmar, Thailand, Laos, all of that region of Southeast Asia, but in pockets, not this wide range. There isn't a wide range.
Yeah, so very small numbers in Cambodia, Vietnam, mm-hmm. China, definitely small little pockets in China.
Yeah.
Malaysia, Sri Lanka.
There. Now, reading the research on why care, I mean, these are large grazers. They do... you know, make a big difference. One of the things that when we talk about these grazers is they clear paths for other herbivores like spotted deer. So they were saying like grazing areas where these other herbivores can come in and get some food because these larger herbivores are clearing out little pockets of vegetation for them to eat. And I did watch a video on it the other day. I saw a tiger take down a female gaur. So they are a prey species for our big cats, which, you know, the tigers are endangered. They're going extinct. So it's important that we keep this synergy going in these ecosystems and these wild areas to make sure it's healthy.
Well, absolutely. I mean, without a doubt, gaurs are ecosystem engineers. I mean, like Chris said, besides from clearing the land and moving around a lot because they're so large with a large size and large feet and stuff like that, but also with their diet, they help disperse seeds throughout their various feeding habits and what they eat. And we'll talk more about that when we get to nutrition because they are grazers, but they're also browsers and eat some fruit. And so, and they are pretty flexible, which is awesome and gives me hope for their survival here in the future. But I mean, they can really, really shape the structure of the forest. And I couldn't find any research on it, but I would imagine for certain plant species, they really help those plant species to be able to pass on their genetics and keep growing and shape the forest. And then, of course, gowers have cultural significance throughout South Asia. It's considered a symbol of strength and power and fertility, and it's often displayed in artwork, and it's talked about in folklore and mythology. So it's just a very well-loved species because of its strength and beauty and size and all of that. And so I obviously fell in love with it this week, and I should have been knowing it my whole life. Most people that are familiar with it do want to help save and protect it, which is why it is a feel-good story, I think, Chris, after looking at all the data this week, for the most part. There's, of course, still some threats with poaching for those horns and probably for meat and a little bit of maybe human conflict going on. But in a lot of areas, in most of the areas, they are protected in reserves. And Chris, I was really happy this week too to find a fair amount of scientific articles based on their nutrition, their habitat, where they're living, their genetics. So whenever I see that for a species, it also makes me very hopeful that there's so many different people, not only conservation organizations or NGOs fighting for them, but also scientists, and it means everybody's working together. And just a quick little shout out before we really dive deep into the evolution and some of the physiology and reproduction. A lot of my information today came from an amazing paper that I read called Bos frontalis and Bos gaurus. And it was in a journal called Mammalian Species from 2016. And the author was Farsid S. Aristani. And the paper can be found at www.mammalogy.org. And it was the dream paper for nerds like me and you that do this podcast because it had everything and all the references. And so, so anyways, I just wanted to reference that for anybody else who wants some light reading later this evening.
Yeah, as you go to bed. Well, before I bring you up, because there is some good stuff with the Gower, just have to give some news that's been posted this week and why we care about each species we cover each and every week that we do this podcast. And that was a lot of you have probably seen this headline, 21 species removed from the endangered species list due to extinction.
Well, Chris, I saw it, and when I read it the first, because I speed read things, and I read the first sentence and I'm like, awesome. And then I read the second part of the sentence.
Yeah. Yeah, usually you think it gets delisted, like, oh, the population's good.
Right.
No, these got taken off the list because they're extinct. We can't find any of them left. So, again, going back to episode one of this podcast, the background extinction rate should be
Don't do it. It's really bad.
Don't listen to it, but people do. But I talk about the background extinction rate should be 2 species a year. Here you have 20 species that just in the U.S. that have gone extinct. I know Australia a few months back, I think we talked about it in a podcast, declared like 15 to 20 species extinct. So our background extinction rate is way above and beyond what's normal. That's why we're in this 6 mass extinction. And to bring this home, I'm going to play the last call of a species. I've done this before, I think, but if you haven't heard it, it really hits hard. So I'm going to play it real quick, and then we'll talk about this bird.
That's the last male of a species singing for a female who will never come.
So that one always gives me chills. That was the last call of the Kauai o'o bird, and that was recorded in 1987. That male was calling for a female that wasn't there, and he died the same year. So that was the last of the species. But again, to declare a species as extinct, it takes many decades to look for it, possibly somewhere deep in the forests or wherever these animals are. And they have not found any more OO birds. So they are now declared extinct with this list. The only mammal on the list was the little Mariana fruit bat from Guam. And I know John, your husband, does some work with the Guam rail because of invasive snakes. I think we talked about that many years ago.
Yeah, the brown tree snake. Mm-hmm.
Yep. So these invasive species on these island nations have been really bad. So that's the only mammal that is on the list in the U.S. territories. The other animals extinct I'd like to read out because, you know, I want to acknowledge their existence on this planet. And sadly, they're gone. The Bachman's warbler bird that was in Florida and South Carolina is now extinct. The bridled white eye bird. The Kauai Akioloa bird, and I apologize if I'm saying these names wrong. The Kauai Nukupu bird. I already mentioned the OO. The Kauai thrush bird. The Maui Kepa bird. The Maui Nukupu'u bird. The Molokai creeper. And the Po'olui bird. So a lot of from Hawaii.
Yeah
just got wiped out.
Should maybe get us an expert out here to talk more about that. Yeah,
what's going on over there? Because I know both you and I love Hawaii. The San Marcos gambusia is a fish in Texas, extinct. The Sciato mad tom fish out of Ohio. The flat pigtoe mussel, Alabama, Mississippi is extinct. The southern acorn shell. The stirrup shell, both mussels in the Gulf region near you. Upland comb shell, mussel. Alabama, Georgia, Tennessee. The green blossom pearly mussel, Tennessee and Virginia. And the tubercled blossom pearly mussel. All mussels. Turgid blossom pearly mussel, yellow blossom pearly mussel. Alabama, Tennessee, Arkansas. So these freshwater mussels, probably just pollution. You know, pollution in our streams and rivers or freshwater. I think the freshwater stuff that's going on, we've had a couple experts on the podcast. That's a silent extinction, not getting a lot of love like our oceans are. And, you know, maybe you and I need to go back into our freshwater fishes or species in the U.S. and highlight some of those and talk about just general pollution. You know, runoff from farms, and we see it here in New Zealand, you know, poisoning and killing off these species.
Oh, and all the pharmaceutics, we have that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Runoff here in Florida.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Where we go and our waste is recycled and you can't get out all the compounds. I remember sitting through a seminar 10 years ago talking about all the fish changing sex ratios and stuff because of progesterone and some reproductive hormones that are flushing through our sewer systems. So, yeah, freshwater systems are in desperate straits. So, and we see in the extinction list. Now, our goal is not to add the gaur to that world extinction list. So to give you some good news, they are vulnerable to extinction, but the population could be as high as 30,000. So we're not in dire straits like some of these critically endangered species. 85% are in India. And as Angie's already said, some of the threats to them, cattle diseases is another one.
Sure. Yeah. And I think you're going to talk about genetics in a little bit too. Mm-hmm. So for some of these species that have declined really rapidly. I mean, the gaur has declined like 70% in the last century. I mean, it's been a pretty big downturn, and there is some upticks now, and and people are working really, really hard on that. But when situations like this arise, the genetic diversity usually declines, and then you get the population to grow and the numbers to grow, which is great. But something like a disease could wipe them all out, right? They don't have their immunity is very similar, not different. So yeah, I mean, it's
yeah, and you teed that up perfectly for me, so thank you. There was a paper that it's coincidence of low genetic diversity in wild gaur populations in Thailand. So it was in PLOS One, just published last August. And it does always bring me back to that Saiga story. And I was just remembering a few months back, I was able to talk to Tom Hugh Jones, producer of Big Beasts, that's on Disney Plus. And I asked him, because he was a producer for Planet Earth 2, when they went out to film this mass migration of the Saiga in the central plains of Asia, and 200, 300,000 of them just dropped dead in a matter of weeks because of this disease, fungal disease that attacked the respiratory system. They didn't have the genetic diversity to withstand disease. So in this paper, they're looking at the gaur in Thailand, and because there's such low numbers, it's really tough for them to breed and spread their genetics. The good news on this story is this particular reserve in Thailand, the wild gaur populations went from 35 to 300 in 30 years. And they're, now that they're kind of outside this area, there is some wildlife human conflict, but ecotourism, these other things are helping boost them. So Thailand's looking for ways to improve genetic diversity. And one thing I think they can do, and we're learning in other parts of the world when we're doing these interventions with low genetic diversity, is we can introduce some outside animals, but they're subspecies. So, you know, then it gets into some questions on that for the people doing that. The other good news for the gaur, I mean, even though their genetic diversity is low in those populations, the good news is there is research. We're not forgetting about them. And
no, definitely not. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. There's a lot of they're paying close attention. They're heavily protected in India and Thailand and a lot of countries within their range. So it's definitely hopeful.
Well, and you're right. India is putting a lot into conservation. In central India, in the Sanjay Dubri Tiger Reserve, they've reintroduced gaur there. They've put in 50 into their original habitat with help of the external wildlife experts. So India is doing all these great things. We had the Asiatic lions. Angie's got an amazing interview coming out soon with a Dole expert. There is a lot of good conservation going on in India. And I know that the tiger population is, the Bengal tiger population is going up. And then the other place that we always love to talk about is Nepal and the gaur populations in this, it's Chitwan and Parsa National Park, has gone from 188 to 388 in 20 years. In Chitwan, and then from 37 to 164 in just 10 years in Parsa. So this isn't a species people are forgetting about, that it's very beloved in that part of the world, and they're really doing a lot to save them. So that's very good. And in this segment, even though I started with really bad news, 21 species that now went extinct, some good news. One of the areas that I keep seeing articles about is this rewilding going on around the world. One place is in the UK. Just last week, I saw an article about rewilding in the UK. And the beaver is one of them. They've reintroduced the beaver there.
That's great.
But all these other little tiny species, insects, plants, small animals, birds, they're reintroducing in parts of the UK. So it's not just the big species like the gaur that's getting the love. It is these other little smaller species too. So chin up. We're going to keep doing this. We're going to keep fighting for these species. And even though we get the bad news, we've got good news, and a lot of people around the world and a lot of people care, like people listening to this podcast. So thank you for that.
Yes, for sure, Chris. Very well said. And I think the gaur is a feel-good story. And I was really hopeful this week diving into the literature, which is always fun too, because then I feel if the conservation story is improving and there's a lot of people studying it, then I can really nerd out about all the physiology facts. like yeah, their vertebral column and that kind of
stuff. Well, we're
going
to get there. Yeah, we're going to get there. We're going to get there. I'm really excited to learn what you researched, Angie, and I think this is a good place for a quick break. We'll get through evolution, and then we'll get talking about this big hump and what it is and how they use it.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, everyone. You may recognize me as Gabby from the History of Everything podcast.
And my name is Brenna, and you don't recognize me from anything yet.
Together, we're two scientists who explore all of the weird little questions and conspiracies of the universe in our new podcast, Mystery of Everything. Everything has an explanation.
We hope.
But that is what we're here to figure out. We will dive into the science behind many popular conspiracy theories, such as vaccines causing autism, flat earth theory, and was the moon landing fake? And if so, why the heck would anyone even do that?
But it's not just conspiracies. There's a lot of cool mysteries that we will attempt to use science to explain, such as near-death experiences, what made the Vikings go berserk, and can I control my co-host with MK Ultra?
Wait, what? Anyway, make sure to check out the Mischief Everything podcast everywhere where you find your podcasts.
Welcome back. All right, so evolution, one of my favorite topics, obviously, and my head's been a lot of horse evolution. Angie and I were just talking about that in the break. It's just like, it just fascinates me.
Yes, we are that nerdy.
Yeah.
You get a 2-minute break and you're still talking about these creatures.
Science and everything. Evolution is just fascinating. So the Gaur, Artiodactyla, these are even-toed ungulates, one of Angie's favorites. The 270 land-based species. And then always with the Artiodactyla, we have... who else in this order? So we have the land-based. I ask you this every podcast, and I'm sure somebody out there is screaming at their car. Angie. Okay. I can't do sounds like dee, 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 or
I know the answer. I'm just making you
you're not.
Sweat what and doucherades. The whales and dolphins.
Okay,
the
citizens. Yes. Okay,
cetaceans.
Okay, 94
not
species.
Citizens. Citizens, that's the parrot.
Yeah.
The cetaceans.
Okay, cetaceans. Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm. Always whales, dolphins, porpoises, 94 species. I can't do sounds, so there you go.
I mean, that you're right. You got to work on it. But okay, I appreciate your effort, and it's fun to make you smile and watch you do some weird charades. That was a weird charade for a dolphin, Chris. All right. That's all I'm gonna say.
It was easy to do the moose when we did the moose a few podcasts back. Okay. Families, Bovidae, 143 species. So, you know, not only are bison, buffalo, antelope, sheep, goats, musk oxen.
We could be here for the next couple of years just doing this.
Yeah, I love the Bovidae. There's a lot of cool animals in there. And then the genus is Bos. So traditionally 5 species, but there's some debate up to 10. But that's including if you include bison in there. And then we get down to Bos gaurus. I would say Bos gaurus for the Gaur. And there are 3 subspecies. So we were just talking about that. So in India, Nepal, and Bhutan is Bos gaurus gaurus. In China, Vietnam, Laos, Thailand, Bos gaurus reddy. And then the Malaysia one is Hubaki, Bos gaurus hubaki. So there are 3 different species. The other bovids.
Species or subspecies?
Subspecies, yeah. So there are others. There are 3 subspecies. Now, when we
I know that's kind of what we think, but then paper genetics. I was reading that I talked about earlier in mammalogy said that the genetic analysis is not conclusive.
There you go.
So always they genetics. Think there's not quite enough evidence, whoever they is, to split B. gaurus into subspecies.
Okay. Okay. Well, then maybe they can. If not, then maybe they can reintroduce some of those Indian gaurus to Thailand because they need some genetic diversity. To save the species, they're probably going to have to do that anyways. When you think of the genus Bos, we think of our cows, our moose. So we have our Bos indicus cattle and Bos taurus. Bos taurus is generally our European breeds, a little bit hardier in the cold. We have them down here in New Zealand. Our Bos indicus are like zebu cattle. They are more warm. So Africa and
they do better here in Florida.
Yeah, they do really well in Florida. Then you have the Bontang, which is a bovid species. Then our bison, you can kind of split it out to American bison, European or wisent bison, the yak, and then the buffalo. We've done the Cape buffalo and, like you said, water buffalo. Bovids, even-toed ungulates emerged 60 million years ago once the dinosaurs went away and Earth could recover. And whatever little mammals could survive, they emerged, and over millions of years, we start to get our small little even-toed ungulates. Where we start to get some bovids or bovidae in Africa, we start to see some evidence 23 million years ago. So species that kind of resemble bovids, where they have horns, things like that. Most of the species came from Africa, so that's where this evolution is taking place. Like I just talked about in horse evolution last week, horses, or in, if you didn't listen to it, Matt, about horses and the one you had to go to the origins of the horse. Horses, rhinos evolved in North America and migrated into Asia, where the bovids originated in Africa and migrated out into Europe and Asia. So really, really interesting, the evolution. And then when you go specifically to the gaur, when we start to filter this down, really, Angie's the one that found this fact for me because I was talking to her before, and I'm like, I just couldn't really find anything specific, but they think gaurs are like 2 million years old, 1 to 2 million years old. So they're ancient cattle. This isn't a breed that emerged 500,000 years ago like humans or species. This is a species that's been around for a few million years.
Yeah, Chris, that's why I had to send you this chunk that I found, because it just blew my mind that this stunning physique, this muscular shoulder hump area and the size and the horns, that's been that way for a really long time. They evolved that way for a reason, right? And for me, it's another reason for why care. Like this is from my point of view, this is an ancient bovid species that we need to make sure stays wild and living in the wild and doesn't go extinct.
Yeah. Well, one of the things before we jump into some other physiology is when we look at evolutionary relationships, we look at chromosome count. The gaur has 56 chromosomes. So that's 28 chromosomes from mom, 28 chromosomes from dad. Cattle have 60. Now you can produce hybrids. This is what I found interesting. I found this little tidbit of info in repro, because I love talking about like hybrids, like making mules or ligers. We talked way back, is that could that happen in nature? No, they're not natural. It doesn't happen. We don't have any.
Don't do it. Don't promote
we don't,
it.
We don't.
I'll
we
get
don't
on my
have,
soapbox.
We don't have liger fossils. We've never found it. Whatever those people say that do this, no, they are not natural. But cattle have 60, yak have 60, zebu cattle have 60, bison have 60 chromosomes. So the gaur is out there. You know, it is definitely an evolutionary unique species to most other cattle. And then when you do breed them, cattle and gaur, the females are fertile, but the males are infertile, like we see in all these other hybrids. Actually, most cattle, if you breed yak and cattle, the American cattle, or American bison, actually, the females are fertile, but the males are infertile. So I'd like to see what those look like. Just old studies. Anyways, off my soapbox with that. It just shows that the gaurs are different than some of these other cattle species or bovid species that we see. Switching to physiology.
Yay!
Yeah.
I've been waiting.
I'm not going to talk too much. It's live up to 30, 20 to 30 is what they see or say in the wild or under human care. One thing I thought was cool, because I always look up speeds. They can run up to 35 miles an hour. What is that, like 55 kilometers per hour? Like, they're as fast as some horses. Like, these things can book it. They're not as fast as pronghorn antelope, but there's a Mack truck. That thing's huge and fast.
Yes. You don't want to mess with it. You're not going to be able to outrun them.
And they're agile. True. They can jump over fences. These things are massive beasts, and, you know, great sense of hearing, great sense of smell, decent eyesight to survive, to avoid being preyed upon by tigers. And then they have this spiny process. I have a skeleton in front of me looking at it.
Oh my gosh, Chris, jinx. Me too. Yeah, great minds think alike.
Yeah. Yeah. So talk about it. This was it, the thoracic vertebrae.
Oh my gosh. Yes, exactly. It's the very tail end of their cervical vertebra, but then moving into the thoracic vertebra, the spinous process, which we have and on ours, but theirs is very, very well developed. And we see this in horses as well. For horses, though, if you can picture it, they have a higher thoracic vertebra spinous process. So in the horse, their withers, they're teeny tiny hump compared to bison, basically is T1, so it's thoracic vertebra 1 through about 5 or 6, it starts to taper down. Mm-hmm. And for horses, that's a really great place to put a saddle because it stops it from like sliding forward, but it's just not extremely prominent unless you've ridden horse bareback certain breeds and and that withers or that those thoracic vertebrae, the spinous process of them can be a little ouchy. But nothing compared to what we see in the Gaur. And that's why I took a whole slide and just put the skeleton up, because it's just so fascinating to look at the bones of this creature, because the spinous process of their thoracic vertebrae are huge, running down pretty much the whole length and only kind of start to taper down where the ribs end and basically the lumbar vertebra begin. And it's just an incredible design. And I always like to tie physiology to function and then tie all that into evolution. Or I like Chris do a little bit more of that. But why have these huge spikes on their vertebral column, right? That run their whole backbone for the most part. It's incredible. But the reason they have these spinous processes that are very, very long, I mean, geez, I'm just eyeballing it here. But what do you think, Chris? Like a foot?
That's what I'm looking. I can't. I've looked everywhere to
more than 6 inches, and this is just the spinous process.
It's a foot. It's a foot. It's just from their back up. Yeah. It's got to be. I'm looking at the skeleton of it, and I cannot for the life of me find the length of it. But if I think, okay, that's 6 feet tall, those thoracic vertebrae from the back stick up at least a foot, at least 12 inches.
Yeah. And then, of course, this is looking at the skeleton, but then I actually tried to pull, I couldn't really find any of the Indian bison, but I found a pretty good 3D muscle animations of the American bison. Mm-hmm. So all the muscle that's laid down around this spinous process to attach to the scapula and the cervical vertebra and then the rib cage. I mean, they needed to be strong, right? That's a given. The stronger, the better for the horns, probably for some of their behavioral components. But this spinous process of the thoracic vertebra allowed them to build more and more and more muscle, because muscle has to have something to attach from point A to point B, right? Like it's always, and that's the whole goal of it, right? Ligaments attach bone to bone, tendons attach bone to muscles, and then muscles lay down all of it. So for me, it's just a beautiful skeleton. We all know that I love horns and hooves, but man, it's just fascinating to see it. And then when you look at just a picture of of the Gaur and you see all this muscling that I'm talking about, then you'll start to understand why I was so giddy talking about the spinous process of a thoracic vertebra, right? That's probably not that fun of conversation. But it really is because it forms this hump. And of course, the American bison have one as well. I don't know if we covered the bison many, many moons ago.
We did. Right? This is a while ago, episode 90. So almost 300 episodes ago. Quite a while ago.
I have no idea if I talked about the spinous process on that one.
I don't know if we did.
Somebody take a listen, critique me. But we were probably more blown away by their conservation story because they were down to so few individuals. And
like 600, yeah.
And probably telling more of that side of the story. But at any rate, that's why we do this podcast, because I'm like a little kid in a candy shop and certain physiology, certain weeks just really get me revved up and get me excited. And this was one of them. The Indian bison hump, it's incredible. And then when you think about the muscling, so around the shoulder blades and around this foot tall spinous process of the thoracic vertebra lay the trapezius muscle. And this muscle is diamond shaped kind of in humans' backs, but and similar in these cattle, but so big and so powerful. And that, of course, helps the neck move up and down as well and support the shoulders, keeps the shoulders in place where they're supposed to be. But then behind that lies a really big muscle called the latissimus dorsi. And these are more going to be your superficial muscles. Of course, there's a lot of other muscles that I'm not really mentioning for lack of time. But the latissimus dorsi is a fun one that basically lays across the thoracic vertebra in the middle, so maybe from like T5 downward. And whenever I'm teaching anatomy class, especially when I used to teach human anatomy a while back, I always called that the hugging muscle. Because it's when you go to hug another human, you're contracting your latissimus dorsi. Mm-hmm. So that muscle is just massive as well on these Indian bison. And and it forms this muscly hump-like appearance. But I would say the hump to me is not quite as prominent as the American bison, but way more muscling, or at least it appears that way from photos.
Well, if you do, so I was able, while you're talking, look up a buffalo skeleton. Theirs is pretty big too, but if you compare it the bison's got that big muscular hump that is part of their back. When you look at the Gaur, it is like he's been in the gym doing head lifts all day, or she, and that muscle is ripped. It's ripped. It's so unique. When you see them, you're like, wow, it is one of the most unique looking hoof stock I think I've seen.
Yeah. And I guess I should be using the technical term. It's called the dorsal ridge of the thoracic vertebra. And the Gaurs have 13 pairs of ribs. So this dorsal ridge of the spinous process runs down the whole thing. But according to the literature, the peak, the tallest one, which doesn't say the size, that's where Chris and I are guesstimating, is right above the fifth or sixth rib.
It's big. It is.
It's fun. And the other thing too is like with this hump, just to clear it up, that it is, it's muscle there. Of course, there's some fat in there, obviously. But it's not a hump like when you think of a camel. We covered Bactrian camels many, that was a while back too as well, where those humps are all fat for the most part. So definitely different than that. And when I was reading about nutrition, it did say that the dorsal ridge muscles and fat, or the hump, if you will, does change a little bit in size depending on their nutritional status, of course. And it will deplete when they're undernourished, but it's not in the same way that we see with the camel.
Well, one of the other physiologies that I think would be fun to talk about, thermoregulation, because they live in, you know, hot, warm climates. I mean, we do find them obviously up in elevation, but if you think of them in Thailand or the lowlands of India, it is hot. And so they have unique structures. One of the things is they have more skin. So they have a dewlap, which hangs underneath them, which Angie was talking about. We were talking about Bos Indicus cattle. Those zebu looking cattle have humps, and then they have these dewlaps that help them thermoregulate. So that when you have more skin, its greater surface area to lose heat. So the body will pump blood to the skin and they sweat, and then that helps evaporative cooling. So they will cool off, also breathe in other ways. When we're cold, you know, or an animal's cold, the capillaries around the extremities will constrict, so there's less blood flowing there. So that's why, like, we get into things with frostbite and stuff, because there's less blood flow there. Anyways, one of the things, cool things they do, as far as diet, I mean, just herbivore, grass, more grass, maybe some leaves, maybe some shoots of plants, things like that. And they're just basically ruminants, like we've talked about in other cattle species, Cape buffalo, bison.
Chris, you're making it sound so boring. I have like 5 slides on their nutrition. But I, for the sake of time and for our listeners, I will speed it up. But yes, the gaur is ruminant, right? So it's kind of fun to think about because they are so large. And as a true ruminant, they have the 4 chambers of their stomach, right? Chris, can you name them?
Oh, geez. I just taught this like last semester. Abomasum, amasum, reticulum, and...
Yes, rumen? Very good. Rumen, reticulum, omasum, and abomasum. Okay. And remember that that's where there are 4 gut fermenters, bovines. So the rumen microbes ferment the cellulose and the food that they eat to produce volatile fatty acids, VFAs, which is actually one of the cow's main sources of energy. And the microbes also produce vitamin B, vitamin K, and other amino acids. So really, really important, completely different than how our stomachs function. Very, very cool. But Chris, what I found really fascinating and perhaps different than the American bison and our domestic cattle is, yes, gaurs will eat grass, but different studies had different percentages. And so one study I found out of Thailand said that they collected feces, which I love. They collected feces and they looked at a whole bunch of different samples, and they guesstimated that only about 44% of the feces was actual grass fragments. They thought that they were doing a little bit more browsing in this reserve where they were studying them. And this was an awesome article I found on the Zoological Science Journal from 2018 called Food and Feeding Habits of the Gaur in the Highlands of Central India. And this is a case study at Pinch Tiger Reserve. So there was a lot of other browse items, leaves, twigs. There was other studies showing that depending on the season, their food preference will vary. And there was another study, maybe this is one in India, where 87% of their diet composed of leaves, which that would put them in the browser category, right? Yeah, 87%. And they're also known to eat shoots. They forage a lot in bamboo, and they will eat bark. And this is often recorded in the summertime. So researchers aren't sure if it's due to a shortage of minerals perhaps in the forage that they are consuming, or just time of year. So the bark from the teak tree has really high concentrations of calcium and phosphorus, and so that might help satisfy some of the gaur's mineral needs, but once again they're not entirely sure. And then when you look at conservation from a nutritional point of view, for some of these browsers, which we know with our African black rhinos, and which are a browsing species, when they're housed under human care, we have a really hard time mimicking their diet as browsers. And because of that, they have nutritional issues from the way we feed them, because we just can't quite mimic what they eat because it's just so different. And so anyways, when you think of having to make sure that these cattle have enough land to be wild and to reproduce and have the correct diet they need, can be a significant factor when it comes to their conservation biology, which no offense, you know, I love you, brother, but just classifying them as like a ruminant grazer, it's not.
Hey, I'm going to say that was way more interesting than what I put together. So I tip my hat to you. Yeah, yes. So,
but once again, why I was excited earlier in the podcast and why I'm still excited tonight at like 10:30 my time is because there's people studying this stuff, right? And here's another paper that I found, nutritional food nutrition research in Thailand, in Khao Yai National Park in Thailand, by researchers there, trying to figure out what they're studying, why it's important, why care, and how this helps their conservation biology. And this, my friend, was in a Nature article. Okay. So, yeah. Okay. you know, if you hit Nature, you're doing pretty well. So, this was a scientific report. So not quite as a little step down from the journal, but still. So yes, we're still learning a lot about them, but I also, what this tells me, what I'm hypothesizing about them from what I read, is that they are flexible. And I do think that flexibility will help them survive, but we need to make sure that we learn more about them, learn more about what they're eating, why they're eating, what they're eating, when they're eating it, to help protect those plant species and overall the conservation biology of the gaur.
Well, and just, two weeks ago, we were talking about your research with rhinos. And so, yeah, I can see why you get excited about it because, you know, when we brought them under human care.
I love eating and pooping. And all animals, humans included, all of it. So.
Yeah. Well, with three babies. Yeah, you've been there, done that.
Still doing it, yes.
Yeah. Well, getting into behaviors, and we talked about they have been as prey species for tiger, but I just imagine a tiger would have a tough time tackling some of these larger males and stuff. So, are they big herd animals like we see with the Cape buffalo? Or are they individuals, small herds?
Yes and no, actually. Yeah. So when it comes to grouping, they typically form smaller herds, anywhere from, like I was reading, 8 to 30, maybe up to 50. But the herd will usually contain an adult bull and several cows and juveniles. But also bull, sometimes there won't be a bull depending on time of year it is, and bulls may form some bachelor herds, or they're quite frequently seen solitary. And so regardless, as a bovine species, a herd species, whether it's just females and a matriarch female there, she'll be dominant. So some of the articles suggested that they're more run by the dominant female, but then other articles suggested that when the male is around, that he's the dominant one and the herd structure will kind of unfold from there. But then just after really trying to dive deep in the literature, is honestly, there's just a lot of absence in details of studying herd dynamics of these guys, especially with their numbers were dwindling for so long, and then they live in the forests and things like that. So they just, we need more solid data on how herds are formed, how they're maintained, and how they change over time. And of course, and we see this a lot in wild horses and all of our pack or herd animals, like wolves. It's not just this simple dominant and subordinate. It's usually, when you actually study the dynamics, it's much, much more complex than that. And that has been suggested by some of what I was reading, is that, we need to dive a little bit deeper. But together, the herds will wander anywhere from 1 to 3 miles a day looking for food. Males can be aggressive with each other if it's during breeding season or they're territorial. But in general, most aggression is what we call ritualized, which basically just means it's to try to say like, hey, I'm a little tougher than you, leave me alone. And usually the one that's not quite as tough or strong or is younger will be like, okay. So there's this fighting, which you can find a couple of videos online. I saw a video of two bull gaurs going at it, and it was, wow, impressive when they hit each other with their horns and kind of move each other around from side to side and stuff. But in general, there's not a ton of aggression between them. It's more just like threats, if you will. But in the wild, gaurs are typically classified as diurnal, so hanging out and eating during the day. But what they've learned is in areas where there's a lot more humans around and impacts of humans on the forest, these scours have become largely nocturnal in certain parts of India. And they're hardly ever seen after 8 in the morning, which is different than what their natural history says. And so once again, I think we're learning more about that, but they're very flexible, which is really interesting. But how is that impacting their diet? How is that impacting their reproduction? Those I don't think we have answers to. But what is known in regards to their behavior is although they're big and bold and can be aggressive to humans, if a human gets too close, there have been a few reports of Bos frontalis, which is the domesticated version of the Indian bison, killing humans that have gotten too close or encroached on them or surprised them. But in general, the gaur is actually very shy and tries to avoid humans at all costs. And that's why they're changing their behavior and only coming out at nighttime in certain areas.
Yeah, it is interesting. And I'm sure other species around the world have. And we know they have, you know, they've adapted to urban environments, things like that. So communication, what are your favorite things?
Well, yes, I am in love with the gaur for so many reasons. But one of my favorite things this whole week was reading how other scientists described the vocalizations made by the gaur. So the various vocalizations have been described in the literature as grunts, moos, high-pitched snorts, growling, snorts, whistles. But my favorite was from in the article that I mentioned at the very beginning of the podcast in Mammalogy. So to quote this paper, the call of the gaur has been described by many naturalists in their own words as the most absurd piping or whistling sound, more like the call of a bird than anything else. And absurd because such a strange sound emanates from an animal so large and powerful. Another one. A most peculiar sound, a cross between the bulging of a wapiti, elk, and the trumpeting of an elephant. But at the same time, a melodious sound that carries a long way like a song.
So do we have any audio?
No, I don't. I found a few videos, but there's other music in the background and they don't capture that. So I want to leave the listeners just wanting more. And maybe you can send me an Indian bison vocalization and see if it captures, if we can capture that. Because I've been reading Harry Potter to my big boys, and then we watch the movie after we read the book, and they're always like, oh man, the book is so much better. And I love that they're already thinking along those lines, because I mean, you really can't go wrong with Harry Potter in any, whether it's the book or the movie. But
yeah,
sometimes I think words are actually better than the real thing. So, but I would love a call as anything with hooves and horns. I want to hear what they have to say. So, yeah.
All right. So with these beautiful songs between an elk and an elephant and everything else, reproduction, you know, what are we looking at with this?
Yeah, well, I mean, you hit the nail on the head, Chris. So the male bull gaur will make this mating call with clear resonant tones, which can carry for up to a mile when it is when the female is in estrus. What researchers do know is that gaurs are not necessarily seasonal breeders, as calves can be born all year round, but there does seem to be a peak around December to June. And a female, her breeding interval is going to be anywhere from 12 to 15 months. And when the female is in estrus, so high estrogen and emitting pheromones that the male can sense and smell, he'll make these beautiful calls to hopefully attract her. And their courtship is pretty cute. There's a lot of licking involved. So, and anybody who's ever hung around a cow, I mean, if you haven't been licked by a cow, you haven't lived, in my opinion. Cow's tongues are really rough. I'm thinking of a dairy cow off the top of my head, but I've been licked by several types of cows. And it's fun. It's like rough and it hurts, but it's also like they just do it all the time. So you kind of have to get used to it. And I was always under the assumption that that they liked me. That was probably maybe a little bit too much of anthropomorphizing, because they're just cows or lickers. And so whether they're doing it for social reasons or who knows what. But in this case, the male will lick the female and her neck and shoulders and her rump for a long time, 5-10 minutes or so. And the male will do the Flemin response, which we talk a lot about with our equid species, but also several bovines will, they raise that upper lip. They look like they're smiling, if you will. When after a male and female do copulate, the female gaur, her gestation period is about 270 to 280 days. So that's a fair amount of time. And let's do the quick math. Is that similar to humans? Because I know our domestic cattle are 9 months, just like us humans. So what's 280 days, Chris?
Yeah, just over 9 months.
Okay, so similar to us, so bless their hearts. That's not a short period of time. And when the female is ready to give birth, she will typically separate herself from the herd to give birth alone. And it's been reported that she'll stay away from the herd for up to like 4 days or so. Mm-hmm. The young calf, oh, talk about darling. The young gaurs are light orange brown in color, so completely contrast to the dark, almost black color of the adult. And they don't have their white stockings yet, so the white stockings will develop around 3 months of age in both sex. And the calf coat hair will eventually change to the dark color of the adults, but boy, are they darling youngsters. Oh my gosh, I just so cute. There's been reports that calves around 2 months old, of course, who are still suckling from the cow, will actually be hidden and laying down motionless, trying to be still as possible. Flat out, they'll lay with their necks actually flat out, not like tucked in like a fawn, and basically trying to be motionless and hold still as probably evolutionary strategy to stay quiet and not die from those tigers that you mentioned, Chris. Mm-hmm. The gaur calves will stick close to mom for up to 9 months nursing. And so they're typically weaned after 9 months. However, they'll stick around their mom's side at least till they're a year and a half, almost 2 years old. And females and males become mature between 2 and 3 years of age.
Well, and it's not a quick generational interval like we see with other species. So probably upwards of 8 to 10 years. And just to highlight again, they are vulnerable. A population up to 30,000, maybe 20,000. So they're not, they're we still got to monitor them, you know, and India is and Thailand is and these other countries. But one thing you can do, and when Angie was talking about teak, is making me think of wood. Sustainable wood is always a big one. And, you know, illegal logging throughout the world is endangering a lot of species. So just a quick list. You can always just go, Google's your friend, look up sustainable wood, like looking for furniture and things like that. Just types of wood that are supposed to be sustainable. Black cherry wood, beech wood, hard maple wood, ash wood, eastern red cedar wood, mango wood, and then of course bamboo. Bamboo is highly sustainable. So these are woods that they're hard woods. They're good for furniture. They grow quickly. The trees can be replenished. So it just as a tip, if you're ever buying wood products or furniture, check where it's from. Check the wood type, see if it's sustainable or not, because there is a lot of illegal harvesting of some very unique woods, hardwoods especially, that is endangering species because people are going in and cutting down their homes. So any organization you want to highlight this week?
Yeah, well, I want to give a big shout out for the gaur this week to the worldlandtrust.org. This is a group I know I've highlighted before because they're really, really important. Their main approach is the conservation of species, both plant and mammal. And their approach is super awesome. Is they basically buy land and partner with tons of conservation organizations to either purchase or lease threatened land and to create nature reserves, protecting both the habitat and the wildlife in the area. And so this organization is definitely involved in India and Thailand, and they partner with different groups there. And this is a great way that people can get involved from their couch because they have events, they have fundraising, they have gifts, they have corporate sponsors, they have friends of the World Land Trust Organization. Of course, they're on social media. So I really like what they're doing. I think it's a very smart approach and a helpful one. And I think that the gaur is one of the many species to benefit from what they do.
No, yeah, it's always good to see these organizations and working, you know, around the world to preserve these animals, and the gaur is one of them. And you know, it's just it's the biggest bovid on Earth.
This is probably the biggest podcast we've done in a while.
And we've got a good list coming. We really do. And so just, you know, saddle up, get ready. We've got some great species coming your way. Some more interviews in the works as people are reaching out to us. So I'm excited for that. And just excited to get back at it after a couple months of dealing with some stuff with family. But Angie and I are back home, ready to go. And I can't wait to record again in a few days, Angie. We got a great species coming.
Thank you, everyone, for listening, sharing, and caring.
Listen, learn, share. Join the movement at allcreaturespod.com.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino.
That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.